This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Today on the show, a $20 million grant to help fight cancer in the Dakotas. But first, a lot of people follow their work, going wherever they're needed, like custom combiners or oil patch workers. Jessica Bruder is a journalist who studies subcultures and economic justice. An article on itinerant workers led to the book Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. The Library Journal picked it as one of the top 10 books of 2017. She put on 15,000 miles following this class of workers, including a stop in North Dakota. She spoke with avid reader and Prairie Public's director of radio, Bill Thomas.
Hi, Jessica, and thanks so much for joining us today. And it is a big day for you because your book, Nomadland, is coming out in paperback today, right?
Yeah, today is the launch.
So that's exciting. And I have to say, I liked your book a lot. I recommend it to other people. But it turned out to be quite a bit different than I expected. I was attracted to it because I caught that part of it happens in North Dakota. It's a nonfiction book about people who have given up their real estate for wheel estate. They've sold their house or gotten out of a rental situation and moved into a vehicle of some kind, usually an RV or a van. And I guess I was kind of expecting a little more sociological version of a book like The RV Life on a Tight Budget or something like that, or The Secrets of RVing on Social Security. And it is partly that. And it's partly also what I was expecting is kind of jolly, spunky people out there living the free life on the road. And there's some of that, too, the great people that are told about in here. But it's also a lot about affordable housing and economics and the changing shape of retirement in our country.
Absolutely. It's a Venn diagram that hits all those points, which, you know, it's fascinating. Grew up, whenever I saw an RV, I thought, you know, there go the last of the great pensioners. They're going to Niagara Falls or they're going to the Grand Canyon, and how cool is that? But as I dug in to work on a magazine story, which then turned into this book, what I saw is that there's another group of people, many of whom found that their retirement dreams didn't quite work out the way they planned. Some of them lost their shirts in 2008. A lot of people lost equity in their homes. Other people found themselves trapped between flat wages and rising housing costs, which are a huge problem culturally right now. And because of that, saying, well, if my biggest expense is housing, what if I cut that and hit the road? And as it turns out, there's a network, a kind of a shadow economy with jobs all over the country that hire full-time nomads in RVs and vans. And that's actually what brought me up to Dakota, was for the annual sugar beet harvest, which is a pretty big employer of this demographic, which calls itself work campers.
Yes, and you got the mud exactly right. We know that mud, and you got to know it too. And we'll get to more of that later. But first, this whole thing. So there's always been people. I mean, nomad is a very old word, and your book is called Nomadland. But you saw this big uptick or upswing in a certain group of people who had gone to live on the road. And as you said, when you were younger, and many of us might have seen like, oh, wow, that's great, that freedom and adventure to be out there. And some of that's true, but you're seeing people who've really been squeezed.
Absolutely. I mean, and perhaps it shouldn't have surprised me when you look at the economic picture. So if you go back to the late 1960s, one full-time minimum wage worker earned enough to lift a three-person family out of poverty. That same person doing that same work right now, that family is in poverty. We've had the federal minimum wage stall at $7.25 an hour for nearly a decade. Meanwhile, housing costs keep going up. So a lot of people have kind of gotten stuck in that wedge. Retirement finance is also a mess. As we know, back in the 80s, 401ks began supplanting traditional pensions. A lot of people haven't saved enough. Even people who did plan well got whacked in 2008. They followed that gospel that housing prices always go up and were taken by surprise. So a lot of people who never expected to become full-time nomads found that the way they could make it work financially was to take to the road, to cut out a mortgage, to cut out utility bills. and, you know, to travel and find jobs as they go.
Yeah, and the phrase jobless recovery and flat real wages, those phrases appear in your book more than once and have an effect on this particular group, which, again, there's different groups of people there are people who are prosperous and having fun driving around in their vans and so on. But,
Absolutely. But
you focused in on this group. And one of the things that made your book so engaging was you didn't just talk about them as a sociological class. You spent a huge amount of time out there with them, participant observation, as they say, and you got to know a lot of them. And in fact, their stories really flesh out the parts that you talk about that are more about social policy and so on. And in particular, there's one woman that you kind of follow through the whole book, and her story was really interesting. Could you say a little about her?
Yeah, absolutely. That person you're talking about is Linda May, and she's 68 now. When I met her, she was just coming up in her mid-60s. And we met in Arizona when I was working on that magazine story. So, gosh, it had to be 2014, the beginning of 2014, and Linda had just taken to the road. She had realized that after a lifetime of working all sorts of low-wage jobs, everything from a cocktail waitress to a defeatherer of quails at a hunting lodge, I mean, you name it, Linda's done that job. She'd also had time out of the workforce as a caregiver for her mom when her mom had terminal cancer, and basically realized that her Social Security earnings were going to come in at under $500 a month, which wouldn't even have been enough to rent the tiny trailer she was living in. At the time, she was working at Home Depot, but she wasn't getting enough shifts. As she got older, she had gone from being a project manager there, which she was really good for because she had lots of skills as a former general contractor, to just getting to work the register irregularly, which was, you know, a little bit ageist and definitely a waste of her talent. So she realized that unless she wanted to work those scant low-wage shifts until she fell down dead, she had to do something else. There had to be another way. She dreamed of building something called an Earthship, which is this marvel of 1970s passive solar eco design. And she had this whole plan. She's got a binder full of printouts with the building plans, but she had to find a way to bridge herself there. She went online. She did what we all do when we have problems these days. She Googled, and she found a website that said, hey, this is how you can live for $500 a month. And you do it by moving into an inexpensive vehicle and, if you need, traveling around to these different jobs. And basically just showed you how to pare your budget down to the bone. And that's how Linda May got out on the road. And she went out to work for a program that Amazon has called Camper Force for RVers. She went out to work as a campground host. And when I first met her in the desert in Quartzsite, Arizona, she had just come off those two jobs and was really just making that transition into finding this nomadic community and becoming, you know, a full-time member.
Yeah, and that was one of the interesting parts of your book for me, and I know you've written about different subcultures, and here it is. There's just like there is with maybe, I don't know, Civil War reenactors and people who follow certain types of music and so on. There's this whole online network. There's a bunch of books, and there's encampments and meetups, and then there are these jobs that many of these people – you say they sometimes call work campers, take people who bring their home with them and go to work. But one of the things you point out is a lot of these jobs are not that great.
Yeah, I mean, because the people who do the jobs are seasonal labor, you know, we talk about how labor's power in the marketplace these days has eroded quite a bit. I mean, that's incredibly true when you look at people who are just on the job and will be moving on. It's not like they can really ask for much in terms of benefits. The wages are typically really low. The work is very physical, which, you know, for somebody in her 60s or 70s or sometimes even 80s might be more challenging than for younger folks. So, you know, while often the jobs get marketed with the excitement, the freedom, the friends you'll meet on the road and all this other stuff. There's definitely another side to them where it's really quite difficult and low-paid work.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me as I was reading this book, and by the way, I should mention again, I'm talking to Jessica Bruder. She's the author of Nomadland, which is just out in paperback, and a very interesting read about people trying to make their lives living in their vehicles and working and traveling. And it one of the things that struck me was the similarity to seasonal harvest workers, migrant laborers, and their work that became very well known by the work to attempt a union, which was eventually successful, the United Farm Workers. And these were people, like you say, they were moving from place to place. They were subject maybe to not being able to get as good a work conditions as they could because of things like that. And, of course, the United Farm Workers did form a union, and you did mention that unions occasionally did try to work with the work campers.
Not the work campers specifically, to be honest. I know
they were trying just Amazon workers in general. Is that what?
Exactly. Different unions have come in and tried to organize folks through Amazon, but not the work campers as a demographic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but often it's funny if you're on a harvest schedule. Do you know what I mean? People are doing that kind of the same sort of liturgical calendar every year, where it's like you're a farm worker and this is what you're doing. These people are so in and out; they'll do it one year, they want another. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I think there are probably different challenges in terms of actually organizing.
In terms of a union trying to organize them.
Yeah.
One of the things you did do was come to North Dakota to work in the sugar beet harvest, though, and I can't really fault you for this. You didn't last that long, right?
Well, yeah. And part of me wanted to stick it out, but I think I was on a particularly difficult piler as well, because it turned out in life in general, I'm not a quitter, but the problem was here, I'm a writer and I was kind of behind and I did have to go home and write. But the other thing was, I learned that within several days of my leaving, just about everybody on my crew had left.
So you were working, you weren't driving a truck, you were dealing with the beets as they were coming in, right? We all
correct.
Living around,
if
you live in eastern North Dakota, you see those sugar beet trucks driving around when the harvest comes and you know it's on.
Those trucks are crazy.
Yeah.
And the fact that you don't need a CDL, a commercial driver's license, I mean, it's really a free-for-all up there. You see the beets on the side of the road. I know there's been a lot of stress over, you know, are there lots of crashes? Should they be licensed? But it's one of the things that kind of blew my mind is that it gets called a campaign, as if this area in North Dakota is almost going to war.
Uh-huh.
Starting on October 1st. Do you know what I mean? There's that military, like, we got to get out there and get her done. And it's going to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, unless the weather gets in the way. Do you know what I mean?
It's just we know what you mean.
You know. I'm still learning.
But the reason that you went there and participated in it and stuck it out for several days anyway was to really feel firsthand what the work was like, that these people, these seniors who've been squeezed out of the housing market and are living in their vehicles, the kind of jobs that they are able to get. And this is one of the kind of jobs they can do.
Absolutely. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, it's not easy work. It's 12-hour shifts on your feet in the cold, on concrete. I met people who had already had entire lives and careers. There was one gentleman who'd driven truck for Walmart, who was parked next to me at the campground, and basically had to beg himself off the night shift because he was starting to go blind and just needing to shift to the day. And, you know, it was really, really hard work, particularly, you meet a lot of older people with medical issues out there too. So, not easy work even for a younger person. I mean, when I was doing it, I just turned 40, but I was probably 37, 38 when I did it. And I figured, if people are doing it in their 70s, this is going to be a piece of cake for me. And my body hurt. It's like all those injuries you think have healed and they all come kind of screaming back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that struck me as I looked at around for reactions to your book, and I read what some people had noted about it, it seemed to confuse some people because you paint in some ways a positive picture of these people. They're plucky, they're clever. Some of them come from relatively wealthy backgrounds. Some of them, like Linda May, have been working more different jobs and not high wage jobs. But a whole mix, some with advanced degrees and some with lots of experience in different jobs. And here they are kind of just scraping by out on the road in their vans and their, some even in sedans or buses or whatever they got. And some people felt like almost there was too much positivity in the book. But I think it was, people coming together in adversity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of feel like that to neglect that, it's funny because there are other people who think the book is too dark.
Yeah, right.
So I kind of think if everybody's coming after you as a journalist, maybe you've done the right thing. Who knows? But my attitude towards the story, which evolved quite a bit as I went in, you go out there and the first thing anybody tells you is, I'm having this great adventure. And then you hang out for a week and then you hear about the foreclosure. And I realized there are a bunch of different narratives and counter narratives happening. And one is that the economy is terrible and it's a mess. And there are not a lot of good paths for people who just want to make a day's wage and live a regular life. Like, we are squeezing out our middle class. But at the same time, I met people who were downright heroic and resilient and creative, and they're not willing to be victims. They don't want to be characterized that way. And it's hard not to admire their spirit. So for me, you can't portray people walking around in sackcloth and ashes and saying, woe is me, if that's not what's out there, right?
That's not how people live.
To give them their dignity and to give them their agency, but to also just show what incredibly long odds they're up against. For me, that was a really important line to walk with the book, was to hit both those points rather than trying to resolve them into some sort of mushy middle.
One of the questions that came to me as I was reading this is, does the thing that we're told by people from other countries is particularly American, this rugged individualism, does that play into the problems that we see facing out as people are going into retirement and facing some of the kind of questions that people face here? One of the things that struck me was, like, they were allergic to the word homeless, right?
Yep, absolutely, because the word homeless, it doesn't mean what it purports to mean. It doesn't mean that you're someone that doesn't have a house. It's really, it's in as much as if we have a caste system in America, that's it. Homeless actually means subspecies. I mean, that's how people treat people they label with that word. And these people, again, they're resilient, they're clever. You really have to have it together to make a life like the way they're doing. It's not easy. So they do resent that label, and they refer to themselves as houseless rather than homeless, because they consider their RVs, their vans, their sedans, those are their homes. They have shelter and transportation. So I think it's almost like a reclamation to say, I'm houseless, I'm not homeless. It's saying, I have some agency, and I'm a person.
You wrote this book, Nomadland. I'm talking to Jessica Bruder, who's the author of Nomadland, that's just coming out in paperback. You started with an article back in 2014, and that's not that long ago, but many things have changed since then.
Feels like a long time ago.
Yeah. So how is this story particularly focused on seniors with a lack of resources for retirement who dumped the real estate and got into a vehicle to live in it? Has that story developed more since you finished the book?
Oh, absolutely. So it's funny. I finished my reporting before the Trump administration began. And a lot of people, when they think of this moment and the moment the book talks about, they think of the current political moment. But the issues that I documented, these were things that were going on, during the Obama administration, before then. Do you know what I mean? These are all really deep-seated issues in the culture.
Right. And 2008 comes in a lot.
Yeah, they continue to grow. So we see more and more that cities all over the country are trying to institute no overnight parking laws. This community, there's a tighter and tighter squeeze on it. Some of the places where people were able to camp back when I was reporting, they can't camp in anymore. Meanwhile, there's been increasing coverage of different demographics. So, for example, all those RVs around Silicon Valley and in different spots of LA where people are barely even traveling at all, but it's just, again, it's this hedge because of flat wages and high housing costs. So people who are doing work in the service economy in areas that are quite expensive to live in using RVs, and that creating or that becoming the epicenter of kind of these municipal conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, when I was almost finished with the book, that New Yorker story on van life came out, which cracks me up. I would argue that van life is a brand rather than a movement, in that the interesting thing there is I think a lot of millennials who are taking to the roads, and not all of them, but many of them are impacted by a lot of the same factors. Surely not retirement, but what about flat wages? Again, there are jobs out there now. We're seeing that unemployment is dropping, but wages are still flat. And housing is still expensive. So for a lot of younger people, they're saying, look, I'd better do this while, you know, I've got my health and I can get out there and I'm curious and I want to run around. And what are the other opportunities there? So again, the positive spin on that is van life, but it's also deeply shaped by economic opportunity.
Yeah. We just got a couple of minutes left, Jessica, and I can't let you get away without saying something about part of Nomad Land that I think a lot of people have run across, which is the campground host. If you ever camp or go through national parks or national forests or campgrounds of Americas, you see these people who are campground hosts. And that job is not as fun and vacation-y as it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, it's marketed as very idyllic, and often it's in these gorgeous settings. So, again, it's easy to see why people might think it's like a paid vacation in paradise. But in truth, these jobs are often very physical. They're low paid. You're doing everything. Some of the companies that hire campground hosts, their uniforms kind of make you look like a ranger because essentially you're in a bit of a security role.
Uh-huh.
You're checking people in. You're babysitting rowdy campers. You're making sure fire pits aren't left on fire. You're shoveling out those ashes. You're cleaning the toilets 3 times a day. Just within the group of people I know who've done camp hosting, I know two women, one in her 60s, one in her 70s, who broke ribs on the job. Like it's serious labor, but I don't think people always think about what it means to be living on site with your job. You know, if campers want, they can come bang on your trailer at 11 at night and say they need help. You're
right,
never really
right
off the clock. And a lot of people don't really get paid for all the hours they're worked. They're pressured often not to file for them. So, again, looks pretty good, but the reality is a little bit different.
Well, Jessica, congratulations on your book. It seems to have touched a chord and be getting a lot of reaction, and you've certainly done, you know, serious and worthy work before, but this one seems to be getting a lot of attention and is on sale as a paperback today. Jessica Bruder, author of Nomadland, thank you for being on.
Thanks for having me.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Western Plains Opera of Minot presents Rossini's The Barber of Seville on Friday, September 14th at 7:30 and Sunday, September 16th at 3. Visiting singers combine with local talent for a fully orchestrated opera experience in Ann Nicole Nelson Hall on the campus of Minot State University. The opera features several famous songs, including Figaro's introduction of himself to the Barber of Seville. Tickets are available at the Western Plains Opera website or by calling 701-858-3191 or at the door.
Still to come on Main Street, a grant to help fight cancer, and Chuck Lura talks about mallards. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. 4 Red Cross volunteers from North Dakota are on their way to North Carolina today as Hurricane Florence makes its way toward the East Coast. Gretchen Jelmstead is the regional communications manager for the Dakotas region of the American Red Cross. She says 2 of the volunteers left in a response vehicle from Fargo this morning and 2 more left from Bismarck. She says 2 more volunteers will hit the road tomorrow and more are standing by.
So right now what the Red Cross is doing is just coordinating all of the resources, the vehicles, supplies, and of course the volunteers as well, just to make sure that the impacted areas have the resources that they need. So in this stage, we're just trying to get everything to the East Coast. So if and when Hurricane Florence hits, we're ready to go.
Jelmstad says volunteers go through trainings before they are deployed to help with disaster and emergency situations. She says volunteers are always needed, so anyone interested can contact the Red Cross to get started. She says if you want to help with hurricane response but can't donate your time, she says financial contributions also go a long way to delivering aid that is needed. Fargo City Commissioners revisited the issue of a condemned vacant house. The rental property is owned by Pete Sabo. Last month, commissioners condemned the property, declaring it a dangerous structure and ordering it demolished by the end of August. Sabo and his attorney, Jonathan Garris, challenged that decision, saying the city would violate state law and city ordinances if Sabo is forced to tear the house down. Garris told commissioners it appears the city has a vendetta against Sabo.
Mr. Sabo has been trying to deal with the insurgents who have somehow got a secondary motive or an objective that is contrary to law, and that is to destroy this building when all the standards say it can be repaired and it should be ordered repaired.
But Fargo commissioners didn't buy the argument. Here's Commissioner Tony Grinberg.
I've heard enough. I believe we stand firm. I'll make the following motion to let the legal beagles figure this out, if so may be.
It's a good idea.
Our decision is made as far as I'm concerned, and whatever motions we make tonight to stay the course, there's the dots don't connect here, Mr. Sable, so I'm sorry for that.
Despite the threat of a lawsuit against the city, commissioners unanimously agreed to again to condemn the house and give Sabo 30 days to tear it down, or the city would do it at Sabo's expense. And Fargo City Commissioners approved first reading of changes to an ordinance that sets bicycle penalties. The adjustments increase most traffic violations committed on a bike from $5 to $20, in line with those committed in a motor vehicle, were recommended by Commissioner Dave Pepcorn at the last commission meeting. Here's Assistant City Attorney Nancy Morris.
So most of them are the same as the driving violations. Running through a stop sign, stop light would be the same as driving violations. We did move from a $40 penalty back down to a $5 penalty of a juvenile riding in the downtown area on bicycle with unaccompanied.
Pepcorn says the change is about increasing safety, calling it share the road and share the responsibility. Commissioner John Strand says he was surprised off-the-cuff comment could lead to an action this quickly and asked if there could be any opportunity for comment because there was little notice of this change coming. Morris says there is time for public input before the commission takes a final vote on the changes. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. There are more than two dozen species of ducks who call North America home. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Lura talks about one that stands out above the rest.
What's the most widely recognized duck in North America? Odds are that you would respond mallard, and that's probably right. Cornell University's All About Birds website states the mallard is the most widespread and abundant duck in North America. The breeding range of the mallard is roughly the temperate and subtropical regions of North America and Eurasia. Historically, however, here in North America, it does not appear to have been native to the New England area and adjacent Canada. Audubon made note of that in his description of the species in his Birds of America. I quote here, "Although it's commonly believed that the mallard is found abundantly everywhere in the United States, I have received sufficient proof to the contrary. This valuable species is extremely rare in the wild state in the neighborhood of Boston. Further eastward, this bird is so rare that it is scarcely known. From New York southward, the mallard becomes more plentiful." Unquote. But the species' popularity, particularly among hunters, has led to widespread introductions around the globe. They're now, for example, a common sight in many urban ponds and parks as well. The interest in mallards, however, is not a recent phenomenon. Domestication of this species goes back around 4,000 years in Asia. Furthermore, the mallard's considered to be the common ancestor of most of today's domesticated ducks, the Muscovy duck being one notable exception. Mallards, of course, are highly sought by duck hunters. It's been estimated that one in three ducks harvested is a mallard. Audubon painted two drakes and two hens among some vegetation in a shallow water area near shore in his Birds of America. But in his description of the species, he accurately described the bird's behavior when a person approaches too close. If you've ever flushed a mallard from the water, you'll relate to his description. And I quote here, "Look at the mallard as he floats on the lake. See his elevated head glittering with emerald green, his amber eyes glancing in the light. Even at this distance, he has marked you, then suspects that you bear no goodwill towards him, for he sees that you have a gun, and he has many a time been frightened by its report, or that of some other. The wary bird draws his feet under his body, springs upon them, opens his wings, and with a loud quacks bids you farewell, unquote. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Hi, I'm Matt O'Lean. Join me Wednesday, September 12th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain, on TV, radio, and online for a half-hour debate in the race for North Dakota Secretary of State. With the candidates, Democrat State Representative Josh Beauchesne, Independent Secretary of State Al Jagger, and Independent Michael Coachman. That's Wednesday, September 12th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain, on Prairie Public's TV, radio, and online streams and apps. I hope you'll join us.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The University of North Dakota Medical School, in collaboration with North Dakota State University, the University of South Dakota, and area hospitals, has received a $20 million grant from the National Institutes of Health. The purpose is to help counter high cancer rates in the Dakotas. Dr. Mark Basson is UND Med School's Associate Dean for Medicine and Research. In an interview with Prairie Public's Dave Thompson, he said the whole purpose is to have the research translate into giving cancer patients better outcomes.
So this has really been a team effort. We started writing this grant 2 years ago. It was UND is the lead institution and the medical school. I'm the principal investigator, our leads at UND. But it's really a consortium. It's a grant fit really to a consortium of institutions, including UND, NDSU, USD, and hospital systems all across North and South Dakota, including Altru, including Sanford, and many of the other hospital systems, as well as the VA, as well as the USDA facility here. So it was a large team of people who got together, I think first about 2 years ago, to try to think about writing this. And the notion here is that it's different from a conventional grant. Conventional grant proposals say, hey, I have this really interesting idea and I want to do experiments to validate it. Here are my experiments. Give me money and I'll do them. This is more about changing the culture of the region to facilitate and grow clinical and translational research. We at UND and our partner institutions, NDSU, USD, have lots of people doing really good science. The problem both here and nationally is that the science doesn't seem often to make it out of a laboratory to the bedside. And NIH talks about this thing they call a bench-to-bedside chasm, that work starts at the lab bench, but then it falls into this chasm and never makes it to the bedside. And it's a national problem. And there's a sense that, gee, we're spending a lot of money on basic research, but are we really getting our money's worth? Are we really seeing the impact we need? It's particularly a problem in this region because our medical schools are community-based. So in some institutions, medical schools have a big hospital that they own. They have hundreds of faculty, physician faculty, who they pay, who mingle with their basic science folks and work for the university. We don't do that, nor does USD. We rely on the kindness of strangers, as it were. We have volunteer faculty all across the state, many of whom are our alumni, who are teaching our students. They're not based here. They don't mingle with our basic science faculty. We often, in many cases, don't pay them. And so they focus, as they should, on taking care of their patients. And our non-clinician faculty focus on doing research. And the question is, how do we get them together? And how do we get discoveries out of a lab into the bed, into the hospital system? And then the second question is, once we've done that, how do we get things to actually happen? So we know that there are a lot of things that do work. Flu shots work very well. Getting a colonoscopy decreases colon cancer rates very well. We know that already. But we also know that not everyone gets a flu shot. Not everyone gets a colonoscopy. And why is that? And how can we change that? That doesn't need another basic science discovery. It needs someone to understand what the barriers are and to move the needle forward in that regard. And people talk about that as the second phase is what we call implementation research. We know what we need to do. How do we implement it? How do we make it happen? And again, many of the people who should be experts in that area may live in the universities, but the people who are dealing with the problem on the front line are in the hospitals. And so that's why it was so important that we put together this consortium of universities and hospital systems to try to address these issues.
So the real challenge that you have is making it a practical use.
Yes, we do lots of really good science, and not just here, but everywhere around the country. The problem is having it have a real impact on our patients. I'm a practicing physician. It's important. I'm a general surgeon. It's important to me that my patients see the benefit of things that I do and my colleagues do in the laboratory. But it's really hard to do that. And so this project is about making that happen. It involves really two separate sets of, maybe three sets of things that we do. One is career development projects, where people will come to us and say, hey, I really want to do that kind of stuff, but I don't have time and I don't know how. And we will buy some of their time. We will provide them with a curriculum to teach them how to do the kinds of things they want to do, provide them with resources to do it, and support some of their work so that at the end of that given project, they will not only have accomplished a project, but they'll be more likely and more able to go on to do the next project. Then we have a separate funding stream for people who say, I already know how to do this stuff, but I just need a little bit of money to get proof of concept to get to the next level. And then at a third level, we will have people who say, I don't need your money. I've got money. I don't need your training. I've got training. But I need your resources. So we have ability for them to maybe come and consult with a group of statisticians over very specialized things that they may not know how to do. We have a big data and tissue banking core that will allow people to access a bank of tissue or perhaps get help accessing a huge database of patients to do answer questions that they know they want to ask, but they just can't get access, and we can provide that.
Is there a bit of demystification in this?
I think that's actually very insightful. I think there probably is. I'm an MD PhD, so I sort of live in both worlds. But the PhDs think of the hospital and the doctors and the patient world as this big, hard to understand thing that they don't know how to get into. And conversely, when you talk to physicians or other clinicians, and I emphasize, I'm not just talking about doctors here. We talked about clinicians and non-clinicians in the grant. So it could be a nurse or a psychologist or a social worker, whatever, on the clinical side. But when you talk to clinicians, they say, I don't really understand what those lab people are talking about, and they don't want to talk to me anyway. And that's the most common thing I've heard throughout my career in multiple institutions, is that both sides, and I use the word sides deliberately here, say, well, I'd love to talk to them, but they don't want to talk to me. Or I'd love to talk to them, but when I talk to them, I don't understand what they're saying. And so our emphasis here is on building bridges and building teams that can not only do individual projects, but can go on to do other things down the line.
It sounds like a safety in numbers kind of argument, too. If you can build the bridges, you can use the expertise by everybody and come out with better outcomes.
Absolutely. I see this as a culture change project, as more than anything else. Yes, we're going to do individual science along the way, and I hope we're going to have some real impact. But I see it as changing the culture in the region so that when the grant project is over, this will go on.
Why were USD, UND, and NDSU selected?
Are you asking why did we select them for the consortium, or why did we get this project over other people?
Why did you get this project over other people? I'm just kind of curious. Do you have an idea?
Well, I'd like to hope because we're the best for the role. I obviously didn't see the competition, and I'm sure there was more than one grant awarded, but some people presumably didn't get their grant. I think there were some novel things in our proposal that I think helped get us funded. One was the real emphasis on team science and team as a culture. So our cores all have leaders and co-leaders. That's not necessarily what always happens. Our executive group is led and co-led. Our projects will all fund not individual researchers, but teams of researchers that include, the pairing of clinician, non-clinician. I think that was viewed as novel. We talked we proposed in the project, and now we will fund not only conventional career development awards for classical academic faculty, but also a separate genre of career development projects for practicing clinicians who are not going to give up their whole lives and become academic researchers. But we need them to be really effective collaborators in clinical and translational research if we're ever going to do that kind of work in this region. And I think that was something that was viewed as novel.
Now, the term you just used, translational research, is very interesting because that goes back to the idea of, you know, demystification and building bridges. It all kind of wraps together.
Yes, absolutely. We talk about translating the work from the bench to the bedside. It really, you're right, does need to be effectively almost in a different language. When the people in the lab talk about things, they're not only talking about their findings in a different language than the people on the wards, but they're looking for different things. Disease is a lot different, or models of disease in a cell culture model or in a mouse model, than it is in a person. And then, as I mentioned, even once you get to talking about a person, every person is different. My mice are all the same strain. They're inbred. That's deliberate because I need reproducible results. My patients are not inbred. Every patient is different. Every patient has a different genetic background, has a different environmental background, and indeed has a different pattern of compliance with my recommendations because of their health beliefs, their resources, their access to care, and the like. And so that translation is a tremendous problem, and it's what we need to do if we're going to move things out of our laboratories.
Was it UND's choice to partner with USD and NDSU?
Yes. I mean, we put together a team to do this. When we started thinking about it here, we decided that we wanted to make this truly a regional project. Some of the other projects that similar projects that NIH funded are more of a hub and spoke model. The university up on the hill, and then a number of other folks out there in the outfield who can collaborate with the big university. Because I think we were talking about team science from the very beginning, we were inspired to reject that model and to build not a hub and spoke, but a network. And that's what we really have here. So our cores are not all at UND. Our resources are not all at UND. Our teams will not be all at UND. They're going to be across the region because that's the way we will best deal with the region.
And it sounds like because of the geographic proximity, plus you have Sanford, who's a big player mm-hmm. in healthcare normally, it sounds like everything kind of came together in an almost a perfect storm for you.
I think so. And I will say Sanford has been very supportive. They're, as you point out, they're very engaged themselves in trying to do research and trying to improve their outcomes. One of our cores is actually located at Sanford, and they've been very supportive of the whole effort. But so have every other hospital. It has been really a team from the beginning. As we started thinking about this idea and I traveled around and I met with the leadership at various hospital systems and I talked to folks at NDSU and USD, everyone just sort of said, wow, that's a great idea. We need that. Let's do that. And then it became a matter of putting all the team together to do the hard work of writing the project. But I don't think anybody said, why do you want to do that? That seems like a waste of time, or that's not our problem or our business. Everyone recognizes that we need to do this kind of work in this region if we're going to address the issues that are really important to the health of patients, the health of citizens in North and South Dakota.
Sounds like you didn't have that much trouble breaking down any silos.
No, not yet. We may yet still have some. But I think people were really intrigued by the notion that this could happen. I think that the universities really want to be doing this kind of work. The hospitals would like it to happen, but have seen themselves historically as distant from the university. Sure, they teach our students, and we are very grateful for that, I say again. But academics was something that people did over in the universities and not something that they really were going to do in the hospital because they were busy doctors or busy nurses and they didn't have time and didn't really know how. And so the notion that we could do this together, I think, has captivated people.
What would you think would be a good outcome? And I know this might be not an end date type research. At least it sounds to me like it. This could be ongoing, perhaps.
Well, so you're right. So this is a five-year funded project, contingent on NIH review every year, but we have allotted money for 5 years if we perform satisfactorily. In theory, this can be renewed once, so we could, in theory, do it for another 5 years after that. What will we achieve? Well, I hope that we will have some very tangible outcomes from some of the individual projects that we will fund. We don't know what they will be yet because we first now need to do that to issue our calls for proposals and select among projects and grow them. I hope that we will have some clear impact on patients. I hope that we will have some material that moves out of a laboratory toward drug development. Now, that may take 10 to 20 years to develop a drug. That's what it takes, but at least we'll get things started. So I think we'll see some real impact. But at the same time, as I may have pointed out before, I think if we simply do a bunch of projects and 5 years later, let's suppose the grant doesn't get renewed, we say, okay, we've done a bunch of projects. Here's some things we did, A, B, C, D, E, and then everything stops because there's no more money, then we will have failed. What we really need to do, I will view as our real success, is if when the grant is over, or even when the grant is going on, people who we have touched in this effort, who we've trained, who we've fostered, who we've induced or seduced, if you will, to collaborate with us in clinical translational research, will go off on their own and say, I have another idea, and I want to do this one now, and perhaps we won't fund it because we won't have any money or we won't even be here anymore, and they'll get their own funding or find their own resources, but they'll go on doing it. That's the real measure of success will be if, when this is all over, 15 years from now, 10, 15 years from now, if there's another generation of a new generation of researchers who are working in this team fashion, working with clinicians and non-clinicians together, universities and hospitals together, to do something about patient welfare and patient care. And while this project is focused on cancer, we hope this will be leveraged beyond it because the same skills that one might use, for instance, to do a database analysis and identify patients who are at risk for a kind of cancer or to identify why it is that Native Americans perhaps have a higher death rate from colon cancer, which they do and which we need to understand better, those same skills could be addressed to problems in heart disease or anything else. So it's about getting the skills and the approaches out there and letting them hopefully pervade the community.
But you folks planted a seed.
We hope so. The seed gets planted October 1st when the money comes in, but we're starting.
Anything else that you'd like to add?
No. This has been a real team effort. That's almost a cliche to say, but I really think it has been. The actual proposal was several hundred pages long, and certainly I didn't write it all. I mean, in fact, I wrote relatively little of it. It was written by people reading each other's work and cycling around, by people who bought into the vision. Now comes the good news is we've been funded. The bad news is we have to do the work. And that's now our challenge, is to do the things we said we would do, and the fun will be having done them or as we do them to see the impact we have. And I'm looking forward to that. And I know everyone on the team is.
That was Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson talking with UND Med School's Dr. Mark Basson. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 11th. The burning question during the hottest weather in summertime in the past in North Dakota was simply this: how can we keep cool? For farmers, there was no getting around the sweaty work of haymaking or wheat harvesting with temperatures in the high 80s or low 90s.
On the hottest days, the farm manuals advised farm workers to keep wet plantain leaves or wet prairie weed leaves inside the headbands of their straw hats to prevent sunstroke or heat headaches. With dehydration and imminent danger, drinking plenty of water was essential, so farmers brought barrels of well water to the fields. Some farmers even brought out large chunks of ice from their ice house. The ice was kept in covered 12-quart tin pails or earthenware jugs and sheltered away under any available shade. The ice would slowly melt over 6 to 10 hours, providing cold water for the entire day. If a sweating worker got tired of plain water, farm families made flavored drinks that provided more energy. One of the best of these was a summertime concoction called switchel, known for refreshing a harvest worker's vitality on even the most sweltering of days. The basic switchel recipe called for 1 cup of maple syrup or brown sugar, 1 cup of apple cider vinegar, 1/2 cup of light molasses, and stirring it all into a quart of cold water. After that, they mixed in a key flavor ingredient, 1 tablespoon of ground ginger. The spice contributed to the overall tonic effect that helped maintain the proper amount of internal heat. Switchel thus quenched thirst and elevated blood sugar levels, while the acid in the vinegar had a cooling effect and gave switchel some zip. On this date in 1913, the Ward County Independent newspaper asked the question, what had become of the old brown jug set beneath the hayrack or wheat shock at the end of the field? Who remembered how to mix switchel in just the right proportions? Actually, over 100 years later, switchel is making a comeback. Entrepreneurs are providing it through food co-ops and other stores. It can also be found online. You can even search up recipes to make your own. A health food to provide energy and electrolytes to help beat the heat. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This is an incredibly dangerous storm.
Several states are bracing for a monster hurricane that's threatening the eastern seaboard.
The storm could be over North Carolina and traveling incredibly slowly, on the order of just a few miles per hour even, which is getting to the kind of speeds that we saw with Harvey.
The latest on Hurricane Florence on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we learn about the Game Changer Ideas Festival coming up in Bismarck. And the theme is In Pursuit of Health and Happiness. One of the featured speakers is Dr. Dhruv Kular, who will be talking about the intersection of purpose and meaning and medicine. We'll also hear from Humanities North Dakota's Kayla Schmidt. That's coming up tomorrow on the show. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.